So last time, we got through chapters 1 and 2 of Ezra, and we had a spirited discussion about whether Cyrus knew about the prophecy of Jeremiah. And he did. It is not in the Bible, however. It's in Josephus. So this is Josephus now. This is the Antiquities of the Jews, chapter 11, 1. In the first year of the reign of Cyrus, which was the 70th year from the day that our people were removed out of their own land into Babylon, God commiserated the captivity and calamity of these poor people, according as he had foretold to them by Jeremiah the prophet before the destruction of the city. That after they had served Nebuchadnezzar and his posterity, and after they had undergone that servitude 70 years, he would restore them again to the land of their fathers, and they should build their temple and enjoy their ancestral property, and these things God did afford them. For he stirred up the mind of Cyrus and made him write this throughout all Asia. And that's basically the same decree that we read last time. Thus saith Cyrus the king, since God Almighty hath appointed me to be king over the habitable earth, I believe that he is that God which the nation of the Israelites worship, for indeed he foretold my name by the prophets that I should build him a house at Jerusalem in the country of Judea. So as part of Josephus's recitation of the decree of Cyrus, he adds on there that for indeed he, God, foretold my name by the prophets that I should build him a house in Jerusalem in the country of Judea. Comment was in Isaiah chapter 44, you will get Isaiah's prophecy about Cyrus. The other prophets don't mention him by name. They simply say it's going to be 70 years. So Daniel, when he's praying, for example, recognizes that the 70 years is almost up. And so he prays to God for release. Ezekiel doesn't prophesy the length of time, simply prophesies for them to settle down. The prophecy in Isaiah 44 is the one that Cyrus was familiar with. I probably ought to say who Josephus was. Josephus lived at the time of the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. He was a Jewish general and was captured by the Romans. And I've forgotten the siege of which city. It was not Jerusalem. He got captured before the destruction of Jerusalem and was made a slave. He was a historian, and he got along really well with the Roman emperor, who moved him to Rome and eventually freed him. He wrote several books. The two big ones are The Antiquities of the Jews and The Wars of the Jews. As I say, he was a historian, well favored by the emperor, once the emperor figured out what he had. And so this Antiquities of the Jews, which we're reading now, recounts the Hebrew Bible. It says in his words, starting with Genesis and going all the way to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans. And his accounts of these things vary somewhat from the prophetic accounts that we read in the Bible. For example, Ezra, when he counts the number of people who go back, I believe he comes up with like 42,000. Josephus comes up with several million. So there are discrepancies between the account in Scripture and Josephus's writings, and I attribute part of that to the fact that he's writing several hundred years later. And so he's relying on other sources, perhaps. As you read Josephus, which I've read the first couple of chapters in order to get this sorted out, you will find that the sequence of events doesn't seem to track the sequence of events in Ezra. He mixes and matches vignettes, and he does it in somewhat different order, so it isn't clear, reading Josephus, what the order was from Ezra. So as I'm reading this, a couple of things I want to get out of it. One, of course, is the cleaning up of the discussion we had about Cyrus knowing ahead of time that he was supposed to do this. And as I say, we thrashed around last week in the Bible and couldn't find it because it's not there. Now, on to verse 2 of chapter 11, and I'm still in Josephus. Thus was known to Cyrus by his reading the book which Isaiah left behind him of his prophecies. For this prophet said that God had spoken to him in a secret vision. Quote, "My will is that Cyrus, whom I have appointed to be king over many and great nations, send back my people to their own land and build my temple." This was foretold by Isaiah 140 years before the temple was demolished. Accordingly, when Cyrus read this and admired the divine power, an earnest desire and ambition seized him to fulfill what was so written. So he called for the most eminent Jews that were in Babylon and said to them that he gave them leave to go back to their own country and to rebuild their city Jerusalem and the temple of God. For that he would be their assistant, that he would write into the rulers and governors that were in the neighborhood of their country, of Judea, that they should contribute to them gold and silver for the building of the temple, and beside that, beasts for their sacrifice. So I'm now going to skip back to Ezra in the Bible. The decree in Ezra chapter 1, verse 2, which we read last time, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem, and let each survivor in whatever place he sojourns be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods, with beasts, besides freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem." Now, something significant here. Notice that the wording is slightly different from the way I read it in Josephus. For example, in the Ezra version, he doesn't say anything about being prophesied. He simply says, "God told me to do this," which is fine. I don't have any problem with that. The other thing that is going to be interesting when we get to where we are tonight, which is the middle of chapter 3, is there's going to be resistance from the people who are already in Judah, and they're going to go and say, "Hey, wait a minute, you got to stop this." And they're going to send a letter off telling the Persian emperor, which was Cambyses by this time, "Hey, these people are building this city, and if they do that, they're going to take the place over and you won't get any revenue beyond the Euphrates." And one of the things to notice in this chapter 1 version of Ezra, it doesn't say anything about rebuilding Jerusalem. It simply says rebuild the temple. Now, in the Josephus version, in Josephus chapter 11, verse 2, "So he," Cyrus, "called for the most eminent Jews that were in Babylon and said to them that he gave them leave to go back to their own country and to rebuild their city, Jerusalem, and the temple of God." So that appears to be the case that the decree includes the city. That decree does not include the city in Ezra. It doesn't give them permission to rebuild Jerusalem. It gives them permission to build a temple at the place where Jerusalem was. And that's going to be important because it isn't until Nehemiah that permission is given for them to rebuild the city and rebuild the walls around the city. So right now, at least according to Ezra, the brief is, we'll give you a whole bunch of stuff, go back and rebuild the temple. And by the way, when they get back, they relocated to the towns around Jerusalem where they had lived before. I'm sure some of them built houses in Jerusalem. I'm not suggesting that. But one of the things they did not do is rebuild the walls, which is key. So, having said all that, by way of catching up from our discussion that we had last week, we got all the way through Ezra 3:5. List of everybody who showed up and list of all the stuff and so forth. In Ezra chapter 2, verse 64, Ezra says the whole assembly together was 42,360. And in Josephus, it's a couple of million. There are lots of discrepancies between Josephus and Ezra. And I'll leave it up to you to decide which one you like. I figured that since Ezra is in the Bible, I'll take that. So they began to rebuild the temple. And the last thing we talked about is just like Solomon, they went up to Lebanon to get cedar trees. And the people in Lebanon, because they had authority from Cyrus to give them whatever they need, cut down cedar trees, made rafts out of them, and floated them down the coast of the Mediterranean to Joppa, where they were then trucked overland to the temple, which is exactly how Solomon did the same thing. Now, chapter 3, verse 8. Now, in the second year, after coming to the house of God at Jerusalem, in the second month, Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, and Yeshua, the son of Jehozadak, made a beginning, together with the rest of their kinsmen, the priests and the Levites, and all who had come to Jerusalem from the captivity. They appointed Levites from 20 years old upward to supervise the work of the house of the Lord. And Yeshua, with his sons and his brothers, and Kadmiel, with his sons and the sons of Judah, together supervised the workmen in the house of God, along with the sons of Henadad and the Levites, their sons and brothers. So they've set up work parties, they've set up supervision and all that kind of stuff. They have arranged to get building material for the temple. So verse 10, and when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests in their vestments came forward with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord according to the direction of David, the king of Israel. And they sang responsively, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever toward Israel. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But many of the priests and the Levites and heads of fathers' houses, old men who had seen the first house, wept with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this house being laid, though many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the joyful shout from the sound of the people's weeping. For the people shouted with a great shout, and the shout was heard far away. This weeping of the old men, those are the ones who had seen the temple in Jerusalem that had been destroyed. Remember, they've only been gone 70 years. So there are still some old men alive who knew the old one, and they're looking at the new one, and Josephus' description of that is different. Here in Ezra, it says they saw the foundation laid and they burst into tears. And you would certainly be forgiven if they were emotional tears of joy at seeing the start of the rebuilding of the temple. That would be how I would interpret Ezra. In Josephus, the weeping doesn't happen until the temple is completed. And the weeping is because the glory of the temple that they just built is nowhere near the glory of the temple that Solomon built. Yeah, we got this temple. Yeah, we got a place to worship. Yeah, it's finished, but it isn't anything like what we had before. And that is Josephus' explanation of why the old men were weeping. The comment was, is it also because the presence of God was not there? And certainly you might say that, but Josephus doesn't talk about the dedication, or at least I haven't read that far where he does. And I've read to where the thing is completed, and that's when the old men start weeping. And their explicit reason for weeping is because this place is nowhere near as magnificent as the one that got torn down. Chapter 4. Now the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the returned exiles were building a temple to the Lord, the God of Israel. And they approached Zerubbabel and the heads of fathers' houses and said to them, "Let us build with you, for we worship your God as you do, and have been sacrificing to him ever since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria, who brought us here." These are what today and in the New Testament are known as the Samaritans. In Josephus, they are Cuthians, because nationality of the people that the Assyrians transplanted after the northern kingdom was destroyed were Cuthians. And so Josephus identifies them that way. Ezra doesn't say where they came from. And by the time we get to the New Testament, they will be called Samaritans, because they live in Samaria. And they are, in fact, there to this day, and they are still called Samaritans. One of the things that happened, the Assyrians, their policy of conquest is when they conquered a people, they would pick them up and move them. So they were moving people all over their empire, and the idea there was to disconnect the people from their native land. We know from the Bible that when Israel conquered the land, they were given tribal allocations, and they were given allocations by family of the land. We also know that in the law of God, every 50 years, anybody who has lost his patrimony gets it back. So in the case of Israel, the piece of ground that you have been given by God via Joshua is yours. So you remember, for example, when Ahab wants to buy a vineyard because it's next door to his garden, and the guy that actually owns it says, "No, there's no way I'm going to sell my inheritance to you." And so Jezebel has the guy murdered, and Ahab takes over his land. So anyway, back to the Assyrians, their policy then was to disconnect people from their land with the intention of then making them easier to govern. So you pick all the people up and move them here, and you pick some other people up and move them there, and so forth. And the idea was to destroy continuity of the people that they had conquered to make them easier to govern. Well, when they did that and moved people into Samaria, it didn't work very well. And the Samaritans, or the Cuthians, said, "Ah, this isn't working well at all. Who's the God here and how do we worship him?" Because again, in pagan understanding, gods were territorial. One of the things you remember when you were listening to the decree of Cyrus is Jehovah is the God of the Jews who is in Jerusalem. So this is a territorial God. In order to worship him properly, we got to get back to his territory. We got to build his temple where it was before, because he's a territorial God. Similarly, when the Hebrews are fighting during the book of Judges, probably fighting the Philistines, and the Philistines say, "Well, theirs is the God of the mountains. Ours is the God of the plains. So what we need to do is get them out here on the plains and we'll be able to defeat them, because we can't beat them up in the mountains because that's where their God is." So of course they lure them down to the plain and they get clobbered, because God says, "I'm not territorial. I am the God of the whole world." All of which is by way of saying what the Assyrians did is they found some captured Levites that they had moved somewhere else. They grabbed them up, sent them back to Samaria and said, "Teach these people how to worship your God." So they went back there and they had a copy of the book of Moses and so forth. And so the Samaritans became worshipers of Jehovah according to the law of Moses. They were taught by a Levite. So when they're coming to Ezra here and saying, "You're building a temple. We worship the same God you do. We follow Moses just like you do. Can we help?" And the Jews say, "No." Very much like they have forever. Well, this naturally rubs the Samaritans, the Cuthians, the wrong way. So what the Cuthians are going to do now is they're going to send a letter back to Persia saying, oh, if you let these Jews rebuild this city, you're never going to have a place on this side of the river because this is a rebellious city. The whole idea being, if the Jews had simply said, yeah, you can carry timber for us or something like that, all that wouldn't have happened. But they had their reasons, and that's the way it is. So I'm all the way down to chapter 4, verse 4 now. Then the people of the land discouraged the people of Judah and made them afraid to build, and bribed counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, the king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, the king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, at the beginning of his reign, they wrote an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. Verse 7. In the days of Artaxerxes, Bishlam and Mithridah and Tabeel and the rest of their associates wrote Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The letter was written in Aramaic and translated. Written in Aramaic and translated, that's going to become key. Artaxerxes here, he is also known as Cambyses. So in Josephus, it is Cambyses who stops the building. Here it's going to be Artaxerxes who stops the building. Same guy. If you read Wikipedia, the names of these guys is loosey-goosey. According to Josephus, it's Cambyses, who is the son of Cyrus and reigns between Cyrus and Darius the First on my timeline. That's when this happens. I don't have him in the list of kings here. I could put him in there, but I didn't. And there's several Xerxes. There's Xerxes I and Xerxes II. And I think both of them are also Artaxerxes. There's a couple of Dariuses, and in fact, there's a couple of Cyruses in there somewhere. It's like kings of England. How many King Georges have there been? I mean, once you get a royal name you like, you stick with it. So verse 8, Ezra 4:8. Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai the scribe wrote a letter against Jerusalem to Artaxerxes the king as follows. Rehum, the commander, Shimshai the scribe, and the rest of their associates, the judges, the governors, the officials, the Persians, the men of Erech, the Babylonians, the men of Susa, that is the Elamites, and the rest of the nations whom the great and notable Osnapper deported and settled on the cities of Samaria in the rest of the province beyond the river. Now Osnapper is who Josephus calls Esarhaddon. This is the only place he's called Osnapper as far as I know. And it probably didn't pronounce it that way. But that's who we're talking about. So verse 10 again. And the rest of the nations whom the great and noble Osnapper deported and settled in the cities of Samaria and in the rest of the province beyond the river. This is a copy of the letter that they sent to Artaxerxes the king. Your servants, the men of the province beyond the river, send greeting. And now be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have gone to Jerusalem. They are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are finishing the walls and repairing the foundations. That's not true. They're laying the foundation of the temple. They're not rebuilding the walls of the city, and they are not, in fact, rebuilding the city per se. That's not part of what Cyrus authorized them to do. So they're not. But the canard here is that they are refortifying this city, and it's going to be just like it was before, this fortified strong point that you're not going to be able to reduce. So verse 13. Now be it known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and the walls finished, they will not pay tribute, custom, or toll, and the royal revenue will be impaired. Now because we eat the salt of the palace, and it is not fitting for us to witness the king's dishonor, therefore we send and inform the king in order that search may be made of the book of the records of your fathers. You will find in the book of the records and learn that this city is a rebellious city, hurtful to kings and provinces, and that sedition was stirred up in it from of old. That is why this city was laid waste. We make known to the king that if this city is rebuilt and its walls finished, you will then have no possession in the province beyond the river. Let me back up a minute. The decree of Cyrus has been broadcast throughout the entire region because there are instructions in there for all the local governors to help them and provide stuff they need, provide sacrificial animals, provide building materials, provide whatever they need. So there is an order out there that everybody should have seen. So the idea that they are accusing the Jews of rebuilding the walls is simply not true. But the king who issued the original decree, Cyrus, is dead. This is his son that is being written to. And as was brought up last week, as I was describing Israel coming back, wait a minute, we ought to call these Jews. And that's correct, but the people who are coming back are Judah, Benjamin, Levi, and refugees from the northern kingdom who fled either as the Assyrians came down or when they saw the golden calf go up. So when the golden calves went up, you had people in the northern kingdom that said, no, and they moved south. So you have members of all 12 tribes within the group that was taken by Babylon. But yes, you're correct. Judah is the major tribe, and they have since come to be called Jews. But by the time of the New Testament, Paul, for example, said, I'm a Benjaminite. So the fact that the tribes are still identifiable and their genealogy is still identifiable goes at least to Paul and probably well beyond. The comment was that Ezra is the first mention of the use of the term Jews in the Bible, and it is not. It's 2 Kings is also there, and that refers to the same group of people because the 2 Kings reference is after Nebuchadnezzar has destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. He put Gedaliah as the governor of this province of his. And of course, Gedaliah himself was murdered, and that didn't set well with Nebuchadnezzar. But yes, that's actually the first use of Jews. And the problem with it is we don't know the sequence of writing of Kings and Ezra and all those kinds of things. So verse 17, the king sent an answer to Rehum, the commander, and Shimshai, the scribe, and the rest of their associates who live in Samaria and in the rest of the province beyond the river, greeting, and now the letter that you sent to me has been plainly read before me. And I made a decree, and search has been made, and it has been found that this city from of old has risen against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been made in it. And mighty kings have been over Jerusalem, who ruled over the whole province beyond the river, to whom tribute, custom, and toll were paid. So what he is talking about there are the kingdoms of David and Solomon. David held sway from Egypt all the way up to the Euphrates River, and his son Solomon did too, simply by reason of inheritance. And obviously you all know the river is the Euphrates River. So Israel was in fact a very powerful and mighty kingdom during the time of David and Solomon. Now it then fragmented into north and south, and all of the surrounding vassal states rebelled. You know, the book of Kings chronicles the Midianites rebelled, the Moabites rebelled, and the various wars, the Syrians came down and so forth. So that David's kingdom, if you will, and they didn't settle all those places, they simply got tribute from them. So Solomon's and David's kingdom disintegrated after the death of Solomon when they split in half and fragmented and so forth. But the thing that Artaxerxes is reading from would have been the history, and it would have made note of the fact that Israel did hold sway over the region from Egypt all the way to Euphrates at one time. So I'm back in verse 20 again. And mighty kings have been over Jerusalem, who ruled over the whole province beyond the river, to whom tribute, custom, and toll were paid. Therefore, make a decree that these men be made to cease, and this city not be rebuilt, until a decree is made by me. And take care not to be slack in this matter. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the king? Then, when a copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai, the scribe and their associates, they went in haste to the Jews at Jerusalem, and by force and power made them cease. Then the work on the house of God, that is in Jerusalem, stopped, and it ceased until the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Let's go through the first six verses of chapter 5. So what's happened, obviously, is all of the people who are not Jews on the other side of the river have ganged up on the Jews and have made them stop. So once they have a decree from the king, they can use force to make them stop, whereas before they have a decree from the king, they would have to fight. So they got the decree from the king. Here's what the king says, you got to stop this. And they quit. Chapter 5. Now the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied to the Jews who were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, who was over them. Zechariah and Haggai, as everybody knows, have their own books of the Bible. And these two guys were both active prophets during this time. Verse 2. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, arose and began to rebuild the house of God that was in Jerusalem, and the prophets of God were with them, supporting them. Notice they do not have authority here, but the king who signed that order is dead. So we're not going against him, we're simply going against the last decree of a king, and this new king hasn't weighed in on it. Verse 3. At that time, Tatenai, the governor of the province beyond the river, and Shethar, Bozenai, and their associates came to him and spoke to him thus, who gave you a decree to build this house and to finish this structure? And they also asked them this, what are the names of the men who are building this building? Have any of you ever watched a World War II comedy, black and white and all that? One of the things that is a routine part of that is you'll get some good guy, and he'll walk around with a clipboard, and he'll walk up to a German and say, now what's your name? And start writing on his clipboard. And the German gets all befuzzled, like, why are you taking down my name? That's what's going on here. These guys are coming up and saying, who gave you permission to do this? Well, I want the names of the people who are doing this. And it's that kind of an intimidation move. And as I say, if you've ever watched a World War II comedy, Hogan's Heroes, any of those, it's sort of a standard thing, and it always is, of course, mocking the rigid militarism of the Germans. Ooh, everything is bureaucratic, and you don't want your name taken down because you get on the wrong list and some, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's what these guys are doing. So it's older than the Germans. Now verse 5. But the eye of their God was on the elders of the Jews, and they did not stop them until the report should reach Darius, and then an answer be returned by letter concerning it. So what they've done here is saying, we're going to keep going, send a letter to Darius, and when we get the letter back, if he tells us to stop, we will, but in the meantime, we're not. So anyway, Darius is obviously a successor to Cambyses, or Artaxerxes, and Darius knows Daniel, because Darius, you remember, is the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Darius was the king that got mousetrapped into throwing Daniel in the lion's den. Remember, all the bureaucrats in Persia ganged up on Daniel, and they went to the king and said, all right, you're a brand new emperor. We need to make a decree that nobody will worship any other god for 30 days. And of course, Daniel didn't do it. So they went and caught Daniel worshiping, brought Daniel before the king, and they said, this guy has ignored your decree, O king. Darius realizes he's been mousetrapped and tries every which way he can to figure out a way not to feed Daniel to the lions, is unable to do that, feeds him to the lions and stays up all night praying. And of course, Daniel is freed from the lion's den, and all those wicked advisors got fed to the lions instead. But the point is, this letter from the province beyond the river saying, hey, wait a minute, these Jews have started building again, is going to Darius. Daniel is his chief of staff and well-known and well-respected by Darius. So when this letter comes from the Samaritans saying, these Jews have started up again and nobody gave them permission, then the letter will come back saying, let them continue. So we'll pick that up next time.